What's up, besties? We are so back. Welcome to part two of our total roast of Dan Brown's masterwork, Angels and Demons. Boo. This is the compulsory bumper where I tell you that we have a Patreon at patreon.com/latentnight, where you can get access to nearly 4 years of video episodes, weekly minisodes, movie and TV commentaries, our awesome fan Discord, and more. As you've maybe noticed, we don't have sponsors, we don't have ad reads, we just have the Patreon. It's the absolute best way to support the show if you like it, or if you don't but have complicated feelings about it, is by checking us out at patreon.com/latentnight. Thank you. As another housekeeping note, we cover the rest of this dumb book, and said dumb book gets into some incredibly dumb stuff about attempted sexual assault, so we'll put the timestamps to skip over in the description if you don't feel like you're in a good headspace to hear Dan Brown trying to get a bingo on the problematic essay trope card. It's not particularly graphic and falls more under villainous mustache twirling, but just want to give you the option if you need it. And with that bummer disclaimer notwithstanding, this is actually one of my favorite episodes we've done in a while. I think just because we're very mad. Enjoy!
Back into it. Part two.
Welcome to part two that is directly continued after part one, because I think both of us are just as fiery as the spirit of Vittoria Vetra.
Yes.
In doing this two-parter nobody asked for.
I don't know when exactly part two is going to come out. This might be the week after. It might be 2 weeks after. Look, if you haven't listened to part one, A, you don't really need to. We're just discussing the Dan Brown book, Angels and Demons. This is Late at Night with Brian Weck. My name is Brian Weck. This is Leighton Gray. Okay, enough intro. We discussed some of the highs and lows of this book on part one. There were no highs.
Only lows and woes.
Lows and woes. I should say that if you want to hear my Golden Globes special, where I discuss my Golden Globes highs, lows, and woes, along with my Oscar snubs and flubs, you can find that on the Patreon approximately. Never.
Wow.
Yes. Also, we have our weekly series, Brian's Fashion Fails, where I discuss some of the more, shall we say, interesting outfits that some modern celebs are wearing these days.
Hot so or not, who well. Wore it best?
Yeah. Who wore it best? Probably Vittoria Vetra wore it best.
Much by like it, her I mean shorts and tank tops.
Yeah, oh, that tank top. Who, hey, baby?
Speaking of Vittoria, I would like to pick up on this quote.
Yes, please.
Alarmed and electrified, she sensed something coursing through her Italian blood that she had never felt before.
Where is this?
This is location in 3512. It doesn't give me pages. The whispers of Sicilian ancestors defending family honor with brutal justice. Vendetta, Vittoria thought, and for the first time in her life, understood.
Understood.
And then my next highlight is, quote, charming. Macri took the jab in stride. She knew her years were showing. At 43, her bushy black curls were streaked with gray. She was too proud for dye. Her mom, a Southern Baptist, a detail we needed to include, had taught Shanita contentedness and self-respect. When you're a black woman, her mother said, ain't no hiding what you are. Day you try is the day you die. Stand tall, smile bright, and let him wonder what secret's making you laugh.
Now, what? Okay, maybe this is an artifact of being written 20 years ago, but even in the year 2000, 43 is not like, well, fuck, that person's old.
I mean, this smacks of Dan Brown was probably 40 when he wrote this and
that's
was feeling 100% really fucked
what it
up
feels
about
like.
It.
Yeah.
Which is cute of him.
Yeah, like, I don't know, whatever. Now, I think he probably took pretty good care of himself by going to the Harvard gym, a location that... And swimming, yes, and swimming.
Like a dolphin.
I'm just going to kind of randomly flip through this. This is chapter 96. He's trapped under the sarcophagus in the fire
with
temple.
His Mickey Mouse watch.
Such a cool detail.
let me remind you, I've read Angels and Demons, Da Vinci Code, and The Lost Symbol. I've not read Inferno. Those are books from 4 and 5. It's bad.
Is Inferno a Langdon?
Yes, it is. And apparently it's the worst out of all of them, which is kind of incredible. It makes me very curious. But I remember reading The Lost Symbol when it came out in like 2009 or something, because I was fully drinking the Flavorade at this point. Mm-hmm. And even then I was like, damn, this shit sucks. But he almost drowns vertically in a sensory deprivation tank. But every book has this callback to like his childhood thing of almost drowning in a well. That he survived. He was the little swimmer that could. Direct quote.
Yes.
Because
the Boston
he treaded
Globe.
Water for five hours. So every book has him in either a situation or like in this one, multiple situations that remind him of drowning, almost drowning.
Yeah, anyway, I'll just read this part. Squeezed by delirium, he fought the illusion with every logical shred of intellect he had. Sarcophagus, he stated aloud, with as much academic sterility as he could muster. But even erudition seemed to be his enemy today. Sarcophagus is from the Greek sarx, meaning flesh, and phagein, meaning to eat. I'm trapped in a box literally designed to eat flesh. Specifically, the sentence I'm calling your attention to, Leighton, is even erudition seemed to be his enemy today. Ah, his longtime companion, erudition, which he's used to turn on so many women on the Harvard campus.
I think around that same scene, I highlighted Langdon gazed through the dusky ghostliness toward the back of the cathedral and studied the outer walls. There are so many like clumsy little turns of phrase here that are baffling. He called like a dark space diaphanous at one point, and that really pissed me off.
That's funny.
It's when he's in the archive I get what he's trying to say, but it's also like, you dipshit.
I think this might be a good time to address the Camerlengo, or however you say his name,
right.
His speech, his big speech.
Hold on. As a preamble to that, I feel like we need to go into his backstory as similarly headline-making miracle child.
Oh, yes, that's right. Speaking of similar, around this scene, actually, the one I just read to you, which now I can only find, I texted this to you and I don't think it went through. By the way, for context, everybody, for the last week, Leighton and I have been texting each other our least favorite sections. I don't know which page this is on, but it's regrouping. He placed the tapered edge of the bone against the crack and shifting his body, he wedged the bone against his shoulder, pinning it in place. Careful not to dislodge it, he raised both hands above him. As the stifling confine began to smother him, he felt a welling of intensified panic. It was the second time today he had been trapped with no air. Now, most writers are not willing to out their shitty plotting quite as vocally as Dan Brown does here. It was the second time today he'd been trapped with no air. It's like, dude, we get it. It was such an egregious retread of a thing he had already done that even the book had to call it out.
There are multiple instances of that I can't think of off the top of my head, but there are several where, and this is a big writer pet peeve for me, is when they'll be like, it was a stupid thought, or like, it was a stupid thing to say, but then stupid line. It's like, that screams first draft. Like, it's not cute.
Don't call it out.
Or just like fucking rewrite it. Like, unless it's so necessary for you to say that this thing that they're saying is stupid, which it almost never is, because there are a million other ways you could do that other than calling yourself an idiot, I guess, which is very evident.
Yeah.
What was this about sarcophagus? What were you going on about?
It was just that, the trapped with no air thing twice in a row. You wanted to talk about something before the Camerlengo.
It was the Camerlengo's tragic backstory, but another example of like, Vittoria doesn't know what iambic pentameter is.
Yeah.
Langdon nodded. Chigi's coat of arms was a pyramid and star. He suddenly found himself wondering if the wealthy patron Chigi had been an Illuminatus. He nodded to Vittoria. Nice work, Nancy Drew. What? Oh, careful, Langdon warned. We don't know for sure that the assassin... But Vittoria was already gone. One strong-willed woman, Langdon thought.
Oh, yep. Yeah. I noted that as well.
Anyway, back to Carlo's mother and her sweet flesh. His backstory is that he was adopted by this beautiful, wonderful nun who instilled in him a deep love of God.
A slender, heavyset nun.
And the church that they were in was attacked by a terrorist bomb, and blood rained from the heavens and blew his mother's sweet flesh. I say sweet flesh multiple times because he really hammers this home. Uh-huh. Sweet flesh apart. And then he was taken in by the late Pope, who we'll have revelations about later.
Oh. Yeah.
Pun anyway, intended. This guy is literally like set up to be the young Pope, and he's like, you know, the vision of dignity and totally not secretly the bad guy.
It's the most obvious thing of all time. Yeah.
And again, with the formulaic nature of all of Dan Brown's books, this character is always there to the point that there's always the fake out bad guy, like there is with Kohler, yes, which is so right. like clearly not even remotely
yes,
like
correct.
Who would fall for this?
The Cardinals.
Anyway, his speech, his awful fucking speech.
Yeah, because this is going to set up a, as we touched on in the last episode, in part one of this, there's this, what now feels incredibly dated positioning of religion versus science. And you can't have one if you have the other. And that's why Leonardo Vetra is such a weird anomaly, because he's a priest who's also a scientist. What? As if that hadn't happened for literally millennia. But,
and like
okay,
half
whatever.
The fucking like scientists that he's talking about in these books, in this book weren't like also bishops.
Yeah, right. And there's this thing where it's like the world is, it's this stupid thing where it's like science exists outside of morality, right? And, you know, he constantly talks about how dispassionate logic can never have morality, which is asserted but never explored, like as whether it's true or not. I don't think that's true. But this idea that you need religion to be moral is so fucking stupid and drives me insane every time someone says it. It's like, it is an old saw at this point. The Camerlengo talks about it ad nauseum, as we're about to hear.
He gives multiple monologues about this, which is really yes. funny because he gives this impassioned monologue direct to camera. And I don't mean that metaphorically. Dan Brown is giving it direct to camera, but literally he's giving it to the BBC camera. And all the cardinals are like, damn, this is the best speech I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Langdon is like, whoa, it's so bad. And oh, I want you to read this bit, like, because the big one that I highlighted is this bit of the monologue that starts in "Science may have alleviated the miseries of disease and drudgery."
Give me a chapter number if you can.
94.
Great. Yep, I have a post-it.
Science may have alleviated, etc.
Yep, that's exactly what I underlined. Okay.
I love in us texting these bits back and forth all week. I love that we're always like, yep, I flagged that one also.
Yep. Yep. So this is the Camerlengo, if we're pronouncing that right, speaking.
Portrayed by McGregor.
Oh, it is? See, I've never
seen
the
movie. They make him Irish in the movie.
Oh, that's good. "Science may have alleviated the miseries of disease and drudgery and provided an array of gadgetry for our entertainment and convenience, but it has left us in a world without wonder." We're going to come back to this point. "Our sunsets have been reduced to wavelengths and frequencies. The complexities of the universe have been shredded into mathematical equations. Even our self-worth as human beings has been destroyed. Science proclaims that planet Earth and its inhabitants are a meaningless speck in the grand scheme, a cosmic accident." He paused. "Even the technology that promises to unite us divides us. Each of us is now electronically connected to the globe, yet we feel utterly alone. We are bombarded with violence, division, fracture, and betrayal. Skepticism has become a virtue. Cynicism and demand for proof has become enlightened thought. Is it any wonder that humans now feel more depressed and defeated than they have at any point in human history? Does science hold anything sacred? Science looks for the answers by probing our unborn fetuses. Science even presumes to rearrange our own DNA. It shatters God's world into smaller and smaller pieces, in quest of meaning, and all it finds is more questions. I'm not reading more.
No, because it keeps fucking going. This goes on for so long.
Science leaves us in a world without wonder. Maybe one of the dumbest statements of all time. Like, have you ever talked to a scientist, dude? You know, talk to scientists and they're like, holy shit, you are not going to believe this thing I found. Oh my God, it's the greatest thing ever. Like, literally every excited scientist is talking about how in awe they are of some new thing they just learned. It's so disingenuous to talk about science as being devoid of wonder, to the extent where it just makes no sense at all.
Yeah, even if, which it's like, this is a very conservative, like hardline Catholic in this example. And we also know that he's wrong and the bad guy.
Yeah. Right.
But it doesn't change how transparently stupid and like straw manny this is.
Yes.
Like it completely elides like, because he's invented this religion versus science argument that ostensibly the book is about, but doesn't actually say anything about it other right. than being like, no. It was a huge deal. The church murdered these scientists, and that's why the Illuminati plot, blah, blah, yeah. blah, contrivances, blah, blah. Robert Langdon is so sexy, blah, blah.
Yes. I think in the context of this, we should also talk about how there's some complete horseshit about how antimatter recreates the Big Bang, which in turn is discovering God, which is kind of central to the whole thing, but makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, okay, fine. If you, I can give you some poetic license, which is if you learned how to create a universe. There's a whole thing, too. It's like antimatter doesn't exist in our universe. We had to create a universe to get it. That's fucking stupid. No. Like, people talk, scientists talk about possible alternate universes, but those would be like other particles that don't interact with ours or whatever. There'd be some totally different fucking thing. It's not like the opposite version of what we have here, by the way, which exists in this universe. You don't need the Big Bang to create antimatter. It happens all the time. But the idea that this would be somehow be confirming the existence of God or something is so asinine. It just drove me nuts.
And that is so controversial that it needs to be suppressed or would be a crushing blow to the church. And that, like, and I guess it is kind of pointed out a bit that, like, the late Pope, who you're never going to believe it, was murdered by the Camerlengo. And even better, he murdered him because he found out that he fathered a child via IVF. But then the child was him.
What? Little Pope. By the way, another thing about that, Camerlengo goes on and on about how the Pope was a deviant, a sinner, a blah, 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 blah. I wanted to be like, dude, your religion's whole thing is forgiveness. Like, isn't the whole point of Christianity that you can be like, please forgive me? And Jesus has to be like, yes, right? Isn't that the whole point?
Yeah.
I might be misreading it. I'm not a Christian.
Well, and it's also like he didn't fuck. I mean, that's the central thing. He's mad at science, right? Oh. In the same way that Maximilian Kohler is angry that he's never felt the touch of a woman because his parents wouldn't give him a vaccine. Yeah. Like, it's the opposite here with the Camerlengo, but makes even less fucking sense.
Yeah.
That his sweet mother, like he's like, what kind of whore would have, what if that whore ever showed up? And what if the child ever came forward? And then Cardinal Mortati, who is the voice of reason here, is
the only good character in the book. Yeah.
The child is you. And then he sets himself on fire.
I wrote down three things I want to talk about. And this is somewhat in context of what we're currently talking about. Here are the three points which I didn't feel would be encapsulated by post-it notes. I have three things written in front of me. Coincidence, forgiveness, and jerking off. The Pope fathered a child. Now, with the mother, you can get the egg out of the mother through surgery, right? How did they get the semen out of the Pope. And there's one way to do it, folks. That Pope jerked off. You know the Pope jerked off because he had to have jerked off. Did you see, just see that thing?
I did see that. Okay. God does not want you to talk about the Pope jerking off.
If the Pope fathered a child without having sex, the papal semen had to get out of the Pope. There's one way that happened. But that is never addressed. So he's like, and in my understanding of Catholicism, which is minimal, it's like Dan Brown level, jerking off is a bad thing.
It's self-pollution, Brian.
Oh, believe me, I know.
That's the term they use, self-pollution. Yeah.
So why are we not talking about how this Pope jerked off? Like Moriarty, who I always want to call Moriarty. Moriarty is like, it's cool. He didn't fuck. It's like, yeah, but homie was touching himself. Like,
maybe the deeper issue here is that Carlo hates jerking off. If his dad had actually fucked, like a little respect, but no, he jerked off into a cup. He has to die from overdose on heparin or whatever.
I think it was a Pope hat he jerked off into. An upside down Pope hat. Yeah.
Behind his bulletproof glass.
Yeah, on top of the tomb of St. Peter, that Pope was jerking off. Unless he went to the Pope jerk-off clinic. Well, I don't know. That probably exists, right? The Vatican seems to have literally everything else. Secret prison, check. You know, necropolis, yep, there it is. Jerk-off room for that Pope, you know they got it.
Yeah. What was this about coincidence?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here's my central question for the book. There's this whole thing. Obviously, the MacGuffin is these shrine, these altars of science that happen throughout the book, right? Now, what was the Camerlengo's plan? Was it to tell people that these were the Illuminati sites? Was he going to release evidence? Because if not, he could have done these literally fucking anywhere, right? But he did them precisely in the locations that someone else could find. And he could have been like, here are the four sites of the Illuminati. We have this information in the Vatican. Guess what? Here's what they are. Don't worry about why. There's a whole thing, but don't worry about it. He could have put them bodies anywhere around Rome and it would have been just fine. Instead, he picked exactly the things that Langdon could find. And I'm like, put them somewhere else and then say, oh yeah, there they are. It's so easily foiled. It's such a self-own to do it in places that there are clues to. Don't leave the clues. Then you're not going to get caught.
Self-own with a dial tone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very good. It's so silly. It's the setup for the treasure hunt. And it's so like flippant because, I mean, you could bring a lot of the Illuminati stuff down to the exact way that Dan Brown handles it, which as is revealed with the Camerlengo's plot is that like the Illuminati stuff is all made up.
Yep.
They just so happen to have the brands in the vault, in the secret vault that only the Pope can see.
Yep.
Why even fucking bother if you hate the science that the Illuminati represents? Why even follow their own shit? And just the fact that we repeatedly hammer home how incredible and amazing and stunning and recalling centuries of Illuminati history, seeing the ambigrams are like, who gives a fuck? Notably, the artist John Langdon, who is Dan Brown's personal family friend, who designed the ambigrams for this book and is also who Robert Langdon is named after. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear that Dan Brown just wanted to like have his friend do some cool ambigrams for his book.
Hey, fair enough.
Which, look, yeah, I get it. That's neat. But the fact that we're still acting like a three-letter word being turned into an ambigram, even Illuminati, how many of those letters in that word can you just flip upside down and they're legible anyway? Like, seriously, modern computers can't even come up with it?
The first and last letters are the same in that word. That's like, problem fucking solved. Like, put a dot at the top and the bottom. There you go.
A man, a plan, a canal, now, Panama.
Yeah. This is a general problem, which I believe we have talked about on the show, although in the distant past, which is almost any time you have a work of fiction with a puzzle or a quest in it. The puzzles are either so fucking obvious that you're like, why don't they see this? This is not like a big reveal. This is clear. Or it's some insane arcane bullshit, which is essentially Deus Ex Machina. And the puzzle, the central puzzle of this book, whether it's right or not, is just, to me, fundamentally not interesting.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm very hard-pressed to think of a thing where there are puzzles that are good. Like a work of fiction with actual good puzzles. And I get it. Good puzzles are hard. I write them. It's hard to come up with good puzzles. And maybe this is a good compromise, but I don't think so.
I think it's better if you don't act like all of your characters are smarter than everybody else for figuring it out. If it's puzzles and the characters are idiots, at least there's a sense of satisfaction that they've solved it and not, we're making everybody fucking stupid, so these puzzles seem smart. While you were saying that, I decided that I would search, because on Kindle you can search a book for a word. I searched the book for the word aroused.
Oh, yes, please. Let me guess how many hits. Does it tell you the number of hits?
I can count. Guess.
Okay. I'm going to guess 25.
No, it's hold on. Let me check for arousal also.
Hold on, I'm going to do the same thing, but in a very different way.
Arousal and aroused combined, it's 8 hits. And I'm going to read you all the hits for aroused. And you're never going to guess what the only character who is ever aroused is.
Oh, yeah. The Pope.
A woman of spirit. I am aroused. Perhaps before this night is over, I will find you. Another quote. He stopped. Patience, he told himself, feeling aroused. There is work to be done. Later, running his palm across her neck, he felt aroused with the knowledge that he could end her life in an instant. Later, cuff of her shorts, higher, he stopped.
Oh, I like, yes, always on
patience,
the shorts.
Patience, he told himself, feeling aroused.
The point is, it happens a lot, and it's always the assassin who says it, and
we've repeatedly stated how the depiction of this character is racist, and we haven't gone into detail because the character is so one-dimensional that he literally
we don't know anything about him.
You don't know his name. You just know that he's the assassin.
He's
there was
Muslim.
A line.
Oh, we know that. We definitely know that he's Muslim.
Yeah, there was a line that was like, hedonism was bred into his bloodline by his ancestors. Gross. And like every single time he calls to make a threat, it's always everyone being like, and his Middle Eastern accent was frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, absolutely. This is the otherest character imaginable. And look, okay, this character is supposed to be a bad guy. That said, the several instances of him being like, and I plan to take my reward later this evening are still so off-putting. It's not even that they're off-putting. They're just stupid.
They're like transparently and so awkward.
It's mustache twirling, right? It's this kind of like, oh, a delectable wench. I shall sup upon her later this evening. It's like, come on, dude. What are we doing?
She is tied to the train tracks. And it also does the stupid trope of like, man who is attracted to this woman swoops in to save her from the day from the sexually predatory, not white guy.
But Leighton, how does she get out? How does she get out of her bondage?
Hold on, I have to find it. That's what I was just about to come to. And I have to find what maybe is the loudest I've screamed at a line in my book, in this book, because
it's incredibly, this is certainly a contender for dumbest line of the book. And I know where you're going with this.
So, Robert Langdon finally locates where the assassin has kidnapped Vittoria and taken him to like the altar, the ultimate altar of science. And there's this big thing where Robert Langdon is holding the idiot ball for a second while he's looking at the map. Here are all the places that we win: earth, air, water, fire. How could these possibly connect on the map? It's a strange elongated diamond shape. And he's like sitting there trying to figure out the significance of diamonds. And this is where the symbology line comes in, right? Or is it later with the Illuminati diamond?
It's with the Illuminati diamond,
Anyway, it takes him a second and he's like, aha, it is a cross. The Illuminati lair is at the center of the cross. Guess what, fucker? If you look at a map of where all the locations are, it's not a cross. Like, honestly, people at home, Google it. It's like a weird little hourglass. Like, no matter how you connect it, because it's very specific about, like, the way that this thing bisects perfectly. The yeah. Bernini sculpture, the Ecstasy of St. Teresa, isn't even in the right church in the book. So, first of all, jot that shit down. Hey, folks, it's an older, wiser Leighton here. I assert several times that the Ecstasy of St. Teresa is not in the right chapel, and because I, unlike Dan Brown, care about fact-checking, I just want to say that for once, he is actually correct. The statue is in the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria. I will freely and openly admit that I was incorrect. So do not, in fact, jot that down. Anyway, he gets to the lair to rescue Vittoria.
Which, again, obviously, this would not be a problem if he hadn't gone out of his way to be like, this is all fact. Believe me, this is true.
I wouldn't care. And the fact that he's like, parenthetical, and their exact locations.
Yes.
Sir? Hello? Anyway, so there's a big final showdown with the assassin and Langdon, and oh no, the assassin is about to throw Langdon off the side of the balcony, and mind you, Vittoria is still tied up after being almost violated by this man. It's like the way that he always talks about, and then she like took a deep breath and she was totally calm because she does yoga. It was like the same thing of like, I'm preparing my body to be violated, but like in a chill Buddhist way.
It's so stupid. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, Vittoria comes up and whacks the assassin with a torch. The assassin's body sailed. The assassin's body sailed backwards over the banister into the night. There was no scream. The only sound was the crack of his spine as he landed spread eagle on a pile of cannonballs far below. Langdon turned and stared at Vittoria in bewilderment. Slackened ropes hung off her midsection and shoulders. Her eyes blazed like an inferno. Houdini knew yoga. End of chapter.
Yep, that's how they did it. Those escape artists, yoga.
And guess what? That's not the last time that we hear about yoga in this
no,
book.
No, it's not.
To write off. No, it's not. My God. Oh, yes, yes. Hold on. I got to had never felt the touch of a woman. Kohler is going into his evil backstory about why he hates Christians. The guards, cruelly it seemed, had stopped Kohler next to a full... Oh, I forgot this is the context. This is so much worse. The guards, cruelly it seemed, had stopped Kohler next to a full-length gilded mirror. The sight of his own twisted form repulsed Kohler. The ancient rage...
I hate this
so much. The
ancient
rage brimmed yet again to the surface. It empowered him. He was among the enemy now. These were the people who had robbed him of his dignity. These were the people. Because of them, he had never felt the touch of a woman, had never stood tall to accept an award. What truth do these people possess? What proof, damn it? A book of ancient fables? Promises of miracles to come? Science creates miracles every day.
Yeah.
I wish I could land a spread eagle on a pile of cannonballs.
Uh-huh. Oh, wait, here's another assassin line I liked.
Oh, do it.
High overhead, the assassin stood over his prey. He ran a hand across her arm. Her skin was like cream. The anticipation of exploring her bodily treasures was inebriating. How many ways could he violate her? It's like...
She smelled of musk.
Musk. So much musk. The assassin knew he deserved this woman. He had served Janice well. She was a spoil of war. And when he was finished with her, he would pull her from the divan and force her to her knees. She would service him again. Yeah.
Once again, child me. He wants her to clean? What?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a bit where they're leaving the archive for the first time and not the second time that Langdon goes to the archive and almost asphyxiates, but then solves it with his strong, superior leg swimmer muscles.
The dolphin.
But hold on. I actually just have to find this bit because there's other things about it that are just so indicative. I just need to search for almond. There we go.
I know we talked about this on text. Did you mention the part where Langdon's like, yeah, kill her. It's better than being raped.
Yeah,
I don't think we got to it, but it's like multiple times. This is another horrible trope about rape and things where it's always like, I would rather she die. Like, okay, cool message to send.
And by the way,
to like,
she's right there. She could say, you know, in this book, she could say something like, actually, no, I don't really want to die. But yeah, it was just like,
this thing that many women, many people of all genders who could be reading this book who have survived shit as an unfortunately high percentage of the population has, that sure makes them feel great. I love to read that. Makes me feel great.
Exactly.
Anyway, hold on. Langdon strode powerfully up the deserted Via della Fondamenta toward the archives, his mind barely able to accept that he was about to be granted access. Vittoria was at his side, keeping pace effortlessly, her almond-scented hair tossed lightly in the breeze, and Langdon breathed it in. He felt his thoughts straying and reeled himself back. What was it? There's something about her mind and legs keeping perfect pace that comes up after this. He'll get a word in his head and then keep using the word for the next couple of paragraphs. Like there's like multiple about asphyxiating.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that with the archive and with the running out of air, Dan Brown himself goes to the well repeated times, but Robert Langdon actually only went to the well once.
Wow.
Well, actually, if he comes back to it in different books, he's constantly going back to that same well, isn't he?
He is. Wow. He really
Again,
is.
Unnecessary calling yourself out as a poor writer.
Oh, here's an exact example of that. She looked at him, sitting there in the driver's seat, his jaw set intently. The man's parents, she decided, must have been frustrated comedians to give him a name like Gunther Glick. Mm-hmm. Okay, Dan. All right. Fucking okay. Langdon saw Vittoria coming toward him. She knelt down, her face like an angel.
Yeah.
His prose is really awkward, and then there's like really redundant stuff that's like, the piece was a fairly well-known Bernini work that was included in some art history texts. Oh, yeah. Basso Rilievo, the guard asked, using the Italian art term. Okay.
He speaks Italian. The guy is Italian. He's talking in Italian.
This is literally a line after Robert Langdon's like, of course, a bas relief.
Yeah.
Hello. The view was staggering like an ocean on fire.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I highlighted that as well. Is there any more egregious thing in this book than the insistence that symbology is a thing? Like, and I know he does this all the time with Langdon, so it's not just this book, but imagine just inventing out of whole cloth an academic discipline and saying it so often that the reader has to be like, well, I fucking guess so. But symbolic, like, what department is this in? Normally you say you're a professor of whatever, French literature. You're in what department are you in? Is there a symbology department at Harvard? No.
He does water polo and underwater basket weaving. And
I like there are several references to like leg presses at the Harvard gym and laps at the Harvard pool as if there's like one of those.
Oh, okay. Here, hold on. I've got some more horrible assassin shit. Uh-huh. The assassin chuckled, cool-tempered but naive. He spoke to me on the phone earlier. He is with a female who seems quite the opposite. The killer felt a stirring of arousal as he recalled the fiery temperament of Leonardo Vetra's daughter. There was a momentary silence on the line, the first hesitation the assassin had ever sensed from his Illuminati master. Finally, Janus spoke, eliminate them if need be. The killer smiled. Consider it done. He felt a warm anticipation spreading through his body. Ugh. Italics. Although the woman I may keep as a prize. Pages later, Langdon is talking about the assassin coming after him. And Dan Brown literally writes the line, striding up the side aisle directly toward him came a dark monster of a man.
Yeah, I know. I saw that.
Fucking gross, dude. And then right after that is the Vittoria, are you alive? If Langdon had known the truth, the horror to which Vittoria would soon awake, he would have wished for her sake that she were dead. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. shut the fuck up. Do I need to put it the same upwards and forwards and backwards for you to get it, Dan Brown? Is that diabolical enough for you?
Well, there's this repeated thing, too, where, you know, he goes out of his way in the book to cast Langdon as, like, simultaneously in and out of shape, right? He's like, he's so yeah. old, but also he's got a swimmer's body and he's a dolphin. And it is this repeated thing that happens with Dan Brown where he wants to have it both ways, right? He wants you to think of this as kind of an old guy, but then the guy does insane physical things. Like, you know, he's at the bottom of a fountain inhaling water and he's fine. He falls out of a fucking helicopter into the Tiber and he's like, it's all chill. What is going on? Yeah, it's this constant thing where he wants you to just not think.
Don't think. Don't question any of this shit.
No, he's just going to say whatever he needs to in the moment to make his point then and there, but then not worry about if it is in conflict with anything else that has happened in the book.
Yeah. Oh, they're really smart. They're the smartest people in the world until yep, they're a fucking right. idiot who doesn't know what iambic pentameter and Nancy Drew are. Here's yeah. the second double down on the rather killed than raped thing. Untie her. The assassin put the knife to Vittoria's throat. I will kill her. Fucking killer dialogue. Langdon had no doubt the assassin was capable of such an act. He forced a calm into his voice.
I mean, the guy just murdered like five people.
Yeah, like in front of you?
Yeah.
I imagine she would welcome it, .. considering the alternative. Like he says it in Wait, front is, of her. Is, You're is right.
That, isn't that the one I just read?
No, because there's another one. There's two. There's the like, if he knew what she was waking up to.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So the Camerlengo gets this quote unquote message from God about where the antimatter is, right? And he says this and he goes to get it. And of course we know he fucking put it there, whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment where Vittoria is like talking about, oh, maybe it's possible we can get messages from God because of entanglement physics.
Oh.
And also like there's this discussion with her father about like, isn't just like having an insight, just a message from God, which, by the way, I don't think is an insane thing to say. Like, sure, okay, you can talk about being inspired. I think it's wrong, but it's not the dumbest thing in the world. But it is a trope to invoke entanglement, which is, you know, there are two particles that can be separated by very large distances, which somehow seem to be connected in a way that, if you don't think about it too hard, appears to violate causality, but doesn't. Invoking that as like, oh, maybe divine inspiration, like God can talk to you because of entanglement. That's the exact same thing as saying any kind of, you know, pseudoscientific nonsense is possible because, oh, that's some quantum mechanics thing.
Yeah.
How can we heal? Oh, through quantum mechanics. It's like, you can't just say words.
That's in the same bit where she's like, miracles? Well, I know that people with placebos have had their cancer cured because they believed in the placebo.
Yes, that's
like,
right.
Hello?
That's not how fucking placebos work.
Oh, my God. Oh,
the entanglement thing drove me insane. Yeah.
Take another shot for describing a woman's weight. A commotion in the doorway behind them caused everyone to turn. Shanita Macri's large frame lurched through the entry.
I underlined that one as well. Did you also like how... because every woman wants to fuck Robert Langdon because he's so old and erudite. Even the woman that flies him to the Vatican after he falls into the river, like drops him off and kind of winks at him and blows him a kiss as he leaves the
yes!
airplane
and also,
or whatever.
When Shanita sees him coming out of the church,
Gunther
is like, who's the dapper? And she's like, I've never seen him before, but I wouldn't mind seeing him again.
Yeah.
I need to find the Velvet Whirlwind quote because that one is maybe the worst offender. No, that's not true. Langdon is in a, he's in a crypt or whatever the fuck. Skeletons by firelight, he grimaced wryly.
Oh, well, hold first on. Skeletons by Firelight is my new Halloween single that's dropping in 3 months.
Just, first of all, grimaced wryly. Brian, can you grimace wryly? Okay. All right. Fair.
Wait, well, actually, let me think. What is a... No.
Because when I think of a grimace, if I'm thinking of a grimace, I'm thinking like teeth bared. Like, okay. That's a grimace?
I don't know.
But wryly? That's not even a joke. think about why Dan Brown would have written this passage. And if you can give me a reason other than because it made him feel clever, I will give you $10. I don't mean that, but, you know, a rhetorical, have it on faith, as characters in this book are oft encouraged to do. Anyway, skeletons by firelight, he grimaced wryly, realizing he had quite coincidentally endured a similar evening just last month, an evening of bones and flames. The New York Museum of Archaeology's candlelight benefit.
Hey, I wouldn't mind one of those, am I
right? The New York Museum of Archaeology's candlelight benefit.
Oh, yes, dinner. Yes. I know exactly the passage you're talking about. I had this
salmon flambé in the shadow of a brontosaurus skeleton. He had attended at the invitation of Rebecca Strauss. Yep. One-time fashion model, now art critic from the Times. A whirlwind of black velvet, cigarettes, and not-so-subtly enhanced breasts. Oh. She'd called him twice since. Langdon had not returned her calls. Most ungentlemanly, he chided, wondering how long Rebecca Strauss would last in a stink pit like this. How many negs was he able to fit into that paragraph?
Yeah.
One-time fashion model.
Yeah. Oh, Dan Brown, said Cindy Crawford. You're the sexiest person I've ever seen. Here's my number. Meh, I might call, said Dan Brown, if I have time. By the way, I know I sent this to you. The Stephen Fry quote about Dan Brown.
Yeah, please read it.
He called Dan Brown's writings, quote, complete loose stool water and arse gravy of the worst kind. shout out to my friend and yours, Chris. Who listens to the show, who you have talked to on the phone, and he alerted me to this Stephen Fry quote.
Wow.
Yeah.
As an example of the arse gravy of the worst kind, here's one that I highlighted just because it's like, this is a mess words-wise. Emerging like a demon from the earthen floor was an old man, .. or at least half of him. He was buried up to his waist in the earth, standing upright with half of him below ground, stripped naked, his hands tied behind his back with a red cardinal sash. He was propped limply upward, spine arched backward like some sort of hideous punching bag. The man's head lay backward, eyes toward the heavens as if pleading for help from God himself. That's just like, no editor was like, do you want to tighten that one up a little bit, Dan?
Is this his first book?
No, it's not. I think Digital Fortress came first, then Deception Point, then Angels and Demons, then Da Vinci Code, then The Lost Symbol, then another one, then Inferno, so I believe.
This is the first Robert Langdon book.
Yes.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. I don't even know what else to say about this. I just hated this book so much.
It was really, really bad.
It's really bad. And then I was looking up reviews of Dan Brown books, and they're not bad reviews. This is the thing that is really shocking to me, is notable publications rave about these fucking books. Clearly, people love them. They're tremendously popular. A dear friend gave me this book because he loved it.
Like, Dan Brown is richer than God.
Yeah. Look, we are ripping this guy a new arsehole, but
24 years late, mind you.
Yeah, but who's laughing at who? I will never have as much money as Dan Brown has. And clearly he has tapped into something that people love. That doesn't mean I have to think it's good, but there are a few things out there that in your life make you feel really at odds with the world. And one of these to me is the popularity of these fucking shitty books, because I've only read the one. I really can't comment on the others. You can. But I read this and I'm like, how can anyone think this is? I can understand thinking it's fun. It is definitely fun. I'm not going to say it's not fun. It is a fun book to read. I read it.
It has twists
in like 2 days
turns.
Or whatever. Fast paced, got all the stuff. Sure. Great. But to think of this as a good book is just unthinkable. It's unimaginable to me. This book sucks. It's relentlessly stupid over and over again.
He sinks himself with that factual thing at the beginning.
Yes.
I would not hate this nearly as much if he hadn't done that and didn't make such a big fucking deal in his interviews about how much research he does. No, he doesn't, clearly. This is like the most easily fact-checkable. What's this Pulitzer one? Oh, yeah. Glick felt dumb. Of course she did. Macri's performance behind the camera last night had probably won her the Pulitzer. Hey, Brian, you want to tell me what's wrong with that one in the year 2000?
Was there not a Pulitzer for this?
No, it was for text. It was for print at the time. There's multiple references to his camera woman winning the Pulitzer.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you can only get it for writing an right. article.
Yeah.
He also like compares himself to Dan Rather at one point.
Dan Rather, like, Rather and Peter Jennings, another famous old man news anchor. Yeah. I don't know. Again, it's been 20 years since I read this book. I remembered it being like not great. Did I remember it being this? Not great. Look at the camera, patreon.com/latenight. No, I did not. I don't even know what else to say about it. It's just fundamentally flawed from every possible perspective. And the worst being that it thinks it's very smart. It's like the science jokes in the book. The science jokes are am I using this word right? Synecdoche of the book itself, where nice. The science jokes are like, look at these very smart science jokes, but they require no thought to actually understand. This book is all about like, look at how smart this book is, but it's not. It's like a D+ at best.
Yeah. I wrote this thing that I wanted to read to you because of how formulaic these are and how I've read many of them at this point. I did not include anything on this list that does not happen in literally all of them. So I'd like to present to you Dan Brown's patented formula for a barely comprehensible paperback thriller.
Great.
Step one.
Do I hear a McSweeney's article?
Step one. Open with a scene of a renowned scholar being murdered by a mysterious figure. Step two, enter hero who is so attractive and smart and attractive and who everyone wants to have sex with. Three, they are secreted away to a discreet location, probably in Europe, by a high-tech helicopter or plane. Step four, grisly crime scene laden with cultic symbols only the hero or someone with a basic high school education can understand. Enter sexy female scientist who had a father-daughter type relationship with said murdered scholar and is distraught but sexy and calm about it. They solve puzzles that lead them on a highly dubious treasure hunt through badly researched and geographically nonsensical foreign locales. Oh no! They're pursued by either a faceless or racist stereotype assassin who has no name or characteristics beyond being evil and having black eyes. Shocking reveal that some fundamental element of the puzzle was actually about something else obvious the whole time. Someone dies! Step 10, probably another person dies. Step 11, there's a bomb or something's ticking down or something. Pressure, keep turning pages, don't slow down or you'll start to question this entire thing. Blah, 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 dubious art history, blah, blah, sexy scientist smolders sexily, Robert Langdon italics, half joke that isn't funny, blah, blah, 15-year-old edgelord atheist takes on religion. Step 13, very smart protagonists find themselves in a life-threatening situation that is eerily similar to a traumatic situation from their youth that they solve with smartness. Oh no, a trusted figure to the protagonist and or sexy scientist is revealed to be the mastermind behind the entire diabolical murder puzzle plot. Said formerly trusted figure gives a big monologue about their evil plan and is swiftly dispatched like a Pixar villain. Dan Brown, I mean Robert Langdon, does a quip. The whole world is watching and simping for Robert Langdon, who once again has saved the day with signature down-to-earth good looks and denim blue jeans. Dan Brown, I mean protagonist, is in a hotel room recuperating from their big adventure, and then the sexy scientist walks in and does really bad come-ons, and then they both make the cringiest flirtatious jokes of all time as someone's hair smells like almonds, and it ends on the worst sentence in the English language as Dan Brown claims his rightfully earned sexual conquest.
That's
the 17 steps to writing a Dan Brown.
Did you just write this?
A couple of hours ago.
I think it's fantastic.
I was really mad about it.
I have a vague companion piece.
Yes, I think that you should. And then I think we wrap up this episode by reading the final pages of Angels and Demons, which I think we've been really been building
what
up
I was
to.
Going to
Great.
Suggest. Now, this is just the beginning of something that probably won't go anywhere, but I was inspired
Will
to
write
it.
Will you tell us the title of it?
This is called The Devil's Variable, a Brian Wecht adventure. Chapter one. Come in, shouted Brian Wecht, following the third insistent knock on his dressing room door. Brian never liked to be disturbed right before a show, since that was when he got his best research and theoretical physics done, with the pre-performance adrenaline coursing through his bloodstream. He could do routine mathematical calculations all day long, and frequently did, but it was always immediately prior to an arena show that he came up with his best ideas. The Wecht equation, the Wecht theorem, and even the Wecht proposal. Those had all come to him within a half hour before walking on stage, with the noise of the assembling crowd thrumming in the background. After a pause, the door suddenly opened. A slender, well-dressed young white woman was standing there, her tight frame accenting her big, chunky glasses, which in turn accented both of her breasts. She had bright brown eyes and a shock of brown dyed into her platinum brown hair. Her tight brown pants sat right below her tight brown lace top, and she sported two tight brown boots, one on each foot. "Hello, Dr. Wecht," she said. "My name is Desdemona Duncan. I'm sorry to interrupt you right before your show, but you come highly recommended, and I'm afraid this can't wait." Brian slowly got up, maintaining eye contact with Desdemona. "Charmed, I'm sure," he purred, reaching for her hand. That's all I got.
We were talking about this via text, and you made a really good, perfect Dan Brown joke about her last name being Duncan, like the donuts. What?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, So what I have not yet written was her name, as I've spelled it here, is D-U-N-K-I-N. And at some point, Brian Wecht will say, "Oh, Duncan, like the donuts." And she'll say, "I don't know what you're talking about."
Because she's so cultured.
Yes.
And slender. Right. And would never touch
also,
a donut.
She's like a PhD computer scientist from Boston, but has never heard of Dunkin' Donuts.
That's even better. Because, you know, if she liked Dunkin' Donuts, it would be important for you to introduce her weight first, as all women exist in Dan Brown's universe.
Yeah, she works at the MIT lab for discrete computer science. And has a joint appointment with MIT and Harvard.
I need a joint appointment after this shit.
Yeah, I think, well, knowing you, you had several joint appointments previously.
Fact check, Brian. I am unfortunately stone cold sober for this. You know.
Which is, I say without judgment. Although, actually, today in the car, Audrey and I did talk about marijuana for the first time.
Oh, wow. Did you play her McGruff the Crime Dog's excellent Pulitzer-winning songs about them?
I should have. I did not. We just talked about it because it came up on a favorite podcast of mine, Away with Words. And they were talking about someone called in and asked, why do we call marijuana pot? And which is an interesting question. And it turns out there's not any very obvious answer. And in fact, the common etymology of that, which was, I forget the guy's name. He was an underworld slang lexicographer who claimed that it came from some Spanish phrase for like potion of whatever. And apparently it's complete nonsense. And the guy recanted it later, but it still shows up in some etymologies and it's totally wrong.
Well, you named a job description that sounds more interesting and realistic than Harvard symbologist.
Indeed, right?
More like shambolicist. We were
listening to that. And I was like, Audrey, do you know what marijuana is? And she said she had heard of it. And then when I said, oh, it's a drug some people take, then she was like, oh, now I get that Preston joke. And I was like, oh, my fucking God.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I think we should, as you say, look, I don't want to rag on Dan Brown too much. Of course, we've only been doing it for 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. You know what? The combined time that you and I spent reading this book this week, and also the time that hours that I spent reading this book as a child and teen, I think we more than earned a little 3-hour treat of screaming that is probably listenable to 4 people in our audience. So we're not going to read this whole final chapter, but I think the opening of 137, which is an echo of something stated previously, and then like the last fucking blasphemy in the eyes of God.
Yeah. All right. So you want me to read what? The very beginning of 137 here?
Yeah. To darkness. By the way, this is the denouement.
Yes.
Carlo Ventresca goes up in a helicopter with the antimatter bomb as a suicide mission. But Robert Langdon got on the helicopter also because he thought they were going to throw it into the ocean or some shit with 4 minutes left. And then Carlo is like, man, you shouldn't have come up here. And then grabs a parachute and jumps out. And by the way, he's a helicopter pilot because he was a medic in the army for a little bit. And it was important that that was established so we know that he can fly a helicopter. Then Robert's like, oh no, what do I do? And then grabs the windscreen from the helicopter to slow his drag as set up by the obese woman in the wind tunnel, falls into the river, coincidentally, directly in front of a fucking hospital. Uh-huh. Ventresca, the Camerlengo shows up at the Sistine Chapel, like, I lived, bitch. And everyone's like, yep. Whoa. And then after his deception is revealed, because before getting shot, by the way, Maximilian Kohler also got shot. And also another guy got shot, but he had a video camera on his high-tech science wheelchair. And in his dying breath, presses a camera into Robert's hand and is like, give this to the media, and then dies. Anyway, so all the cardinals get to watch on a TV that was wheeled in the video because Carlo didn't know that Robert survived from the helicopter. And then this starts a whole spiral where once again, Carlo's deception is revealed and everybody hates him. And then he's like, but don't you see? I'm having my monologue where it turns out I'm crazy because I love Jesus so much. Ha ha ha. Why are you all looking at me weird? And then he, like, I don't know, later he sets himself on fire in front of everybody. The whole idea was that he was going to set up, like, oh, this massive existential threat by science. I'm going to solve it. And then miraculously survive. And then, yeah. You know, fuck. Anyway, problem solved. He sets himself on fire. Bada bing, bada boom. Moriarty becomes new pope.
Can we address one thing before I read this, which is why would you give the Camerlengo a name that's so similar to Vetra?
Yeah, it's pretty
it's
bad.
Ventresca and Vetra, like, just make it a little different. I kept getting confused. All right.
You know, there are a bunch of orphans in this book. Yeah, they all have their major traumatic childhood event. One is Vittoria grew up in an orphanage where a single father adopted her. Fact checked this, a single man could not adopt a child from an orphanage like that. That's like their laws. You can't as a single person. Anyway, what's the matter? Everything's the matter.
I'm surprised that
flashbacks.
The Camerlengo's last name wasn't like Duo Facesca. Anyway.
Yes, the mysterious caller who called, you know, who was Janus to the assassin. Well, it was Carlo.
High atop the steps of the Roman Colosseum, Vittoria laughed and called down to him. And by the way, this is a direct callback to the beginning of the book. Robert, hurry up. I knew I should have married a younger man. Her smile was magic. He struggled to keep up, but his legs felt like stone. Wait, he begged, please. There was a pounding in his head. Robert Langdon awoke with a start. Darkness.
Blah, okay. Blah, blah. He's in a bed in a hotel room and it's magical. Ooh, and then he's remembering the past 24 hours.
A bed where people fuck.
Also, Vittoria like showered him and put him into the bed. And now he's awake and her bed's empty and he can hear her showering. And they're at a hotel. And then the fucking Swiss guard shows up and is like, what happened in the helicopter? And Langdon is like, wink, I don't remember.
Yep.
And the new pope gives Robert Langdon the Illuminati diamond brand. Because surely he'd want a nice reminder of all that murder just watched.
Does it come up in the Da Vinci Code that he knows the Pope and can just call in kind of any Pope favors he wants?
I forget.
Because it fucking should, right?
Yeah. Oh, hey, we've got a codex that if we shake it or break it, it's going to fill with apple cider vinegar and this like fit. I mean, this dude also destroyed, like there's no consequence. He destroyed the Vatican archive. Like I know it's a trade-off for like him saving the day or whatever, but ultimately did anything they do actually matter?
This is what I'm saying. Like
Kohler shows up anyway. Gets the video of Carlo confessing. All along, he was just going to fly that shit up into the air. You're so right. No, nothing they did fucking mattered other than killing the assassin.
They went back to the Vatican at the end, the place they started.
All of the cardinals died, as it would have been if they hadn't fucking showed up. They didn't need to understand shit about the antimatter. The Swiss Guard trying to find it, of not believing them.
No, I know. I totally agree with you.
Inert.
Yep.
Anyway, Pope is totally fucking cool. Anyway, I also, before we get to the final page, I want to get to the part where they echo the things that the assassin was saying about her.
Oh, yes.
But like in
a
sexy, fun way now, because they're not an imminent threat.
She ran a hand through her luxuriant hair. The neck of her robe falling open slightly. And now, I suppose you want your reward. The comment took Langdon off guard. I'm sorry? We're adults, Robert. You can admit it. You feel a longing. I see it in your eyes. A deep, carnal hunger. She smiled. I feel it, too. And that craving is about to be satisfied. Very surprised he didn't say satiated here. It is. He felt emboldened and took a step towards her. Completely. She held up a room service menu. I ordered everything they've got. You know how they do that? Where you take a room service menu and you're like, one of each, please.
Also, anyway. Yeah, room service, famously really delicious and good.
And so available in European hotels.
Yeah, with boysenberry cream, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now, let's see. Yeah, I'm going to start from here. I got it.
I think you find that ambigram terribly interesting, don't you?
That's exactly where I was going to start. Layton, that's
where
exactly
it all goes off the rails.
Yep. So they ate. They ate that food. They ate everything from the room service menu, even the gross stuff, even the weird stuff, even the cold stuff. And now they're hanging out. And by the way, also something that happened this scene is the Pope was like, anything you guys need, you got it. Just like hit me up later. The Pope. Okay. Like you guys need any extra artifacts, please. And he gave them the diamond, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. The brand was on the dead mastermind of this murder plot that Langdon was so traumatized by seeing five dead bodies with the brands. Anyway, fuck.
Yeah. You find that ambigram terribly interesting, don't you? She demanded. Langdon nodded, mesmerizing. Would you say it's the most interesting thing in this room? Langdon scratched his head, making a show of pondering it. Well, there is one thing. That interests me more. She smiled and took a step toward him. That being? How you disprove that Einstein theory using tuna fish? Vittoria threw up her hands. Dio mio! Enough with the tuna fish. Don't play with me. I'm warning you. Langdon grinned. Maybe for your next experiment, you could study flounders and prove the earth is flat. Vittoria was steaming now, but the first faint hints of an exasperated smile appeared on her lips. For your information, Professor, my next experiment will make scientific history. I plan to prove neutrinos have mass. Neutrinos have mass? Langdon shot her a stunned look. I didn't even know they were Catholic! With one fluid motion, she was on him, pinning him down. I hope you believe in life after death, Robert Langdon. Vittoria was laughing as she straddled him, her hands holding him down, her eyes ablaze with a mischievous fire. Actually, he choked, laughing harder now. I've always had trouble picturing anything beyond this world. Really? So you've never had a religious experience? A perfect moment of glorious rapture? Langdon shook his head. No, and I seriously doubt I'm the kind of man who could ever have a religious experience. Vittoria slipped off her robe. You've never been to bed with a yoga master, have you?
The end.
The end.
That's humiliating, Dan
Brown. It really, really is. What?
You should be embarrassed. I guess to build up to this, I should have read the final pages of Deception Point, which are arguably worse.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah, I sent them to you, right? The fish jokes?
Yes.
Yeah. It's just as bad. But the final bit is like, what can you tell me about the mating rituals of advanced primates? And he's like, I don't know. And she's like, slips off her football jersey. Well, nature boy, I suggest you learn fast. Why does he keep doing this? And I checked in the Da Vinci Code. It ends with a chaste kiss and it's a date. So clearly he got his shit together a little bit and decided to be a little bit less embarrassing. But even that sucks. Mm-hmm. It's all this like,
it's fucking
we've known
James
each other
Bond
for 24
territory.
Hours. We've only known each other 24 hours. Let's fucking bang.
It's every James Bond movie at the end where he's with the Bond girl and they're, and you know.
A lot of vagina. Then yeah. newest character.
Do not disturb, you know, or it's like, come on, what are we doing here? Yes, they've known each other for 24 hours. And also, this woman's father was just murdered brutally in front of her. I could be wrong. I don't think we're in the mood to like eat room service and fuck.
And it's also like, would you not feel a sense of deep uselessness that you didn't actually stop, prevent, or solve anything?
Well, and it is just predatory. This woman is in the middle of all kinds of traumatic stuff. The fact that you're jumping in on this and being like, well, time for a yoga master in bed. It's like, what? Give her fucking space. You can call her in a month or two and it's going to be fine. And if she's into it, great. It is exactly the this man is taking his reward thing that they call it out as being.
Okay, her father was murdered. Horrific corpse, the weapon of mass destruction, as they put it, that she created, just threatened the entire Vatican. They watched four gruesome murders, a branding. They watched Carlo go up. She had the trauma of watching Robert go on a suicide mission that she thought that he died from. He comes back. Carlo comes back. Immaculate, you know, here's an actual miracle. Then she watches Maximilian Kohler, who's essentially her godfather, get shot in front of her after, you know, she thought that he was the bad guy. Then she watches Carlos set himself on fire in front of the entire world. It hasn't even been 24 hours. Oh. Like, that's generous.
Now I'm horny.
Oh, and she almost gets raped. Did we forget about that part? That's she got kidnapped, knocked unconscious multiple times, and nearly raped. The last thing that woman wants is to fuck. Are you serious?
Look, he's a symbologist. He should be able to read the fucking signs.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this two-parter of Late Night.
Just remember that I can be your angle.
or demon.
Or you are demon.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Blessings to you, listener, and curses to you, Dan Brown.
Yeah, may you enjoy your gigantic pile of money that you earned by writing shit.
And your Dutch horse trainer that you cheated on your wife with.
Oh, shit. Dude fucked a horse? That's crazy. Late Night is produced by Brian Wecht, Leighton Gray, and Jarek Centeno. Follow us on Twitter at Leighton Night, on Instagram at Leighton_night, or email us at leightonnight@gmail.com.